You're listening to the Two Tongues Podcast. And now your hosts, Kyle and Chris.
Guten Tag, and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Two Tongues Podcast. Solo episode coming at you today. I want to say another episode of Opinion Scholarship, but that is not exactly the case today. Pull out this book here so you guys can see it. I bought a book called Legends and Popular Tales of the Basque People. Didn't need to buy it. You can find it for free, digitized online in a number of places, I've learned. It's an old book. It was written in 1887 by a lady named Mariana Montero. I discovered that she is a Portuguese folklorist. She wrote a bunch of things. Thing is, it's difficult to find any information on her because there is a very beautiful actress, I think a Portuguese actress, by the same name, born in 1988. So the lady we're talking about today is not her. This person was publishing in the very late 1800s and the early 1900s. Not at all the beautiful actress that you should Google if you have a moment. She wrote the myths of the Basque people, and we've brought that up on an occasion or two on the podcast, why the Basque people, they live in the mountainous region between Spain and France, why they are particularly interesting, because the Basque people speak a language that is not an Indo-European language. So all of the languages, basically, in Europe are connected. So even we all know about the Romance languages. We know about Latin being the kind of origin of French and Spanish and Portuguese and all that. And there's very, very close associations between them. Even in the Germanic languages, the Celtic languages, there's a whole genealogy of connections. And that is not the case with the Basque people. They live in the mountains. What tends to be true for people who are isolated geographically by mountains or desert or oceans, they tend to stay a little bit more isolated. And so what we have with the Basque people is a very ancient population of people who were there before the Indo-European, I don't know if invasion or migration, whatever you want to call it, that these people that came probably from the steppes of southern Russia went basically all over the world. We talked about this before. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but these people called themselves Aryan, the Proto-Indo-European people. And we see that name, Aryan, reflected in the name for Ireland and also the name for Iran. So you see the distance that the people, these Indo-European people, made in their migrations. They probably went even further than India or Iran and India. We certainly know they were in India. So anyway, these people were dominated at some point in our deep history, and yet these Basque people that live in the mountains in again between Spain and France managed to remain basically unmolested by the Proto-Indo-European people. They managed to keep their own culture, their own language, and it's unique. It's a fucking anomaly. Like there's no other languages that exist that are related to it. Other than other Basque dialects, it's like, you know, it's a real mystery, a real interesting mystery. And the reason I find it particularly interesting is because their myths and religion, the prehistoric or primitive religion that those people followed once upon a time, they're not related to the stories that we're always talking about. They're not related to the tradition that makes up the Bible. They're not related to the tradition that makes up the pagan religions that were brought in by the Proto-Indo-Europeans. And that includes all of them. That includes the Norse religion. That includes the Greco-Roman religion. It includes various religious traditions in the Middle East, not least of which the Zoroastrian tradition. It's not related to any of those. And so it's kind of an interesting case. It's like, can we learn about this European religion that has very, very, very ancient origins, that's not related to all the rest of the typical stories that we talk about, that's not related to the typical pantheons we talk about. You know, what kind of window, what kind of insight into, you know, human culture and European history and the history of religion might that Basque, you know, tradition give us? And so I wanted to kind of get into it. I'll tell you that the author, Mariana Montero, published a book, a number of books, but I just wanted to give you some idea of the kind of stuff she was talking about. Obviously, the Basque folklore we're going to talk about today. She also wrote a book on the Sibylline oracles, which I'm actually really interested in. I think I'm going to have to read that one. She wrote a book about Christopher Columbus and about St. Jerome, and there are others. But just to give you some idea, it seems to me like this interest in folklore is connected to the not only her authoring this book about the Sibylline oracles, but even about Christopher Columbus and all the legends that circulate around Christopher Columbus. If you don't know, there's some very interesting stuff around Christopher Columbus. Nobody really knows where he came from. There's suspicion that he was a Portuguese Jew. There's suspicion that he was Spanish. You know, there's different names. Colombo, I think, just different versions, variations of the name. And so there's some mystery surrounding even who Christopher Columbus was. There's also a record in Christopher Columbus's travelogue when he was coming to the New World that he encountered crazy lights in the sky, and there's like a UFO people that jump on board with that story. Interesting stuff about him. But you can see what I mean with all these like legendary stories that are told around characters like Christopher Columbus or St. Jerome. This is the kind of stuff she seems to be interested in. I just, you know, really wasn't able to get a lot of detail and information about her as a person to kind of open this up because, boy, it's, I mean, give it a go. See what you can find on her. It's very difficult because this actress, this Portuguese actress that's popular today, all the articles are about her. If you try to search for her name with other keywords like scholar or, you know, author or whatever, there's lots of other Portuguese people with that same name who are academics. So it's like, good luck. Good luck finding any history on her. But so that's kind of the best I can do. And then what I wanted to do here is I wanted to talk about one particular myth. In fact, it's the first myth that she presents in the book. I want to read it sort of in summary, the way we've done with some myths before, kind of like Louise von Franz style. So this was my idea for this one. When we were reading Carl Jung and we were reading Louise Marie von Franz and Ed Ettinger and some of these Jungian people that were talking about myths from a psychological perspective, I thought, it's kind of gung-ho about it for a while, that I was going to get the Brothers Grimm, I was going to get Hans Christian Andersen, I was going to start reading some of these things and trying to do some of the similar analyses that von Franz did to the fairy tales and Ettinger did to the Greek myths. I was going to try to bring some of that to you, and I kind of got away from it. But this whole Basque category kind of re-intrigued me to kind of starting this project. So what I want to do is read one of these Basque stories. Remember, unaffiliated, unassociated with really any of the other stories that we are supposed to be familiar with as Westerners. Very unique. And we're going to see what kind of archetypal things, motifs are there, you know, what kind of comparative religion we can do, compare and contrast to stories we know about, just try to understand what it might mean. But also, I really just want to tell the story. And one of the things I'm coming to realize is that I love stories. So everybody loves stories, right? It's why we watch movies. It's why we read books. I love stories. I love story form podcasts. I have really fond memories of my grandfather telling stories, family stories or stories from when he was a kid or whatever, and just sitting around the table listening to grandpa tell stories. And it's like seriously a fond memory of mine, like one of the fondest. And then when I listen to podcasts, like the ones I like so much, I've been listening to a lot of the Y Files, and I brought that up a few times, but hearing the stories being told by AJ on the Y Files, just one of those things I kind of think maybe I should be doing some more of. So this is going to be my attempt to not only tell a story, because I enjoy stories and this is a good one, but do the kind of analysis and deep digging that I like to do along the way. So I'm going to give this a go. See what how it goes. You tell me what you think. If you like it, well, I'll certainly do more of them. I also want to mention that the myth that we're going to talk about today was written down after the Basques converted to Christianity. So much more recently in modern history. But the story itself is something passed down from oral tradition. God knows how old it is. You know, if you ask some of these anthropologists about stories we're familiar with, like Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Rumpelstiltskin, you know, Hansel and Gretel, if you ask anthropologists how old these stories are, they will tell you that potentially these are oral traditions that are 10,000 years old. You know, there's a Cinderella as an example. There's a Cinderella story that is eerily similar to the Eastern or to the European version that we're familiar with in China, and it's ancient. So it's like some of these stories are very, very ancient. These are legends. These are folklore. We can talk about it like that, but in truth, these are myths. These are ancient religious myths, stories that were told, including religious characters, you know, giving information about, you know, the religion itself. These are myths. And God knows how old they are. But what's unique about them is that just like we see with some of the records of Norse religion, they were written down after Christianity had taken over. And so they actually adopt Christian motifs, Christian characters. And it's kind of interesting, actually. If you read that, like in the Norse context, you'll know what I mean. It's very interesting. It's like talking about things that are very pagan right alongside things that are very Christian. And so you can see that the context in which they were being merged, you kind of see this battle going on between these various ideologies or traditions and how they're synthesized, you know? So we're going to see a little bit of that today. So I just kind of, even though we're talking about what I think are ancient oral traditions, you're going to see things in here that are familiar to you that really obviously aren't as old. And again, these are some of the Christian names and motifs that you're going to see. All right, so the first story I want to talk about here from the book, first myth, it's called Aquilaire. Probably mispronounce a lot of these things, so forgive me. It is the origin story of a sacred mountain. That's what we're going to talk about today. The origin story of a sacred mountain. And you may be familiar with these sorts of stories. They come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. We just had a total solar eclipse here not long ago, and I remember telling my daughters during the eclipse that certain Native American tribes understood that the eclipse was the cosmic serpent swallowing the sun. And so as you see the sun start to turn progressively more dark black, that is the, symbolically, it is this cosmic serpent that's swallowing the sun, and then it's sort of reborn, so you have this death and rebirth scenario, that this is a myth that explains why the sun disappears during the eclipse. There are lots of others, you know, lots of interesting stories, like, you know, we have one in the Christian tradition that's along these lines. Why do snakes not have legs? Why do they slither upon the ground? And we have a whole story about that, the serpent was once able to talk, you know, from the Bible, the Garden of Eden, was speaking to Adam and Eve, that, you know, was once able to move around more easily, and it was cursed. The snake was cursed by God for what it did to Adam and Eve in the garden, and it was forced from that point on to slither upon the ground, right? It's, you know, these are the kind of myths that I'm talking about. They're explanatory myths, and in this case, it's explaining why this mountain, Aquilaire, is a sacred mountain. All right, so the beginning of this kind of introduces the mountain. So this is, we're not really going to be talking about the myth here, but a little bit more of an introduction. The book explains that aquilaire is composed of two words, lair, which means pasture, and aquera, which means a buck goat or a he goat, right? So the word aquilaire signifies the pasture land of the goat. So this mountain, you can imagine, is full of mountain goats. You know, you've probably seen images of them precariously climbing up these sheer rock faces, and you're like, how in the world are these goats doing that? And of course, they eat everything. They do fine in that environment, even though it's rocky and very, very few other things can live there. The goats seem to do just fine. So aquilaire is this mountain, which is a pasture for goats. That's what it's known for. That's what it's named after. But it's not just that. It's not named after the goats just because there are goats on the mountain. It's remembered or named after the goats because a goat is a well-known animal that represents the evil one, right? So we all know that there's goat imagery associated with the devil, right? Cloven hooves. We got that like Greek god Pan sort of thing with the kind of the hairy legs and cloven hooves. For the devil, we kind of understand that symbolism goes together. We also have the fucking goat's weird looking eyes. If you've ever seen the goat, if you've ever been on a freaking farm or a petting zoo, you know what I'm talking about. Crazy square shaped pupils. What is going on? They're creepy looking creatures and they're associated with the devil. You guys can probably picture right now, a Church of Satan or whatever, images of the devil. It's usually like a pentagram and a goat-headed man. This is what we're talking about. The goat imagery is associated with the devil. And guess what? So is this mountain. It's associated with the devil. I want to say that it's not at all uncommon for mountains to be sacred. And we're going to talk more about that. This mountain is, I think, historically a sacred mountain. In more modern times, it became associated with the devil. It's my opinion that that is a later interpretation. And maybe it has to do with the pagan gods being considered demons by early Christians, which was not an uncommon thing to do. So if the mountain was associated with a god, when the Christian era comes around, that god is now a demon. The mountain is now an evil mountain rather than a sacred one. So there could be things like that going on. I just think that there's a really fine line between the mountain being sacred and evil, if that makes any sense. All right, so that when the book opens the story up, it says, in the territory between the towns of Zagaramurdi and Echalar will be found isolated and darksome the mountain of Aquilaire, overgrown and surrounding by rocks and waterfalls. It is said that Ariel, the genius of the Biscaynes, now this he's using the word genius here like Socrates did, like a spirit or an angel. So Ariel, the angel of the Biscaynes, one day stretched out his arm and wrenched from its base this singular mountain, placing it at a distance from its companion so that they should not become contaminated by contact with this accursed mountain. All right, let me just highlight what's being said here. There's this particular place in Basque country, in the Biscayne country. This is a dialect of Basque in like the Spanish region rather than the French. An angel picks up this cursed mountain, rips it out of the ground, and sets it somewhere all by itself. So you have to understand, this is an isolated, they call it an isolated and darksome mountain. This is one mountain separated from all the others, seemingly like an island all by itself. It's weird, right? This is a mountainous area, lots of mountains around. Most of them are all, you know, close together and on top of each other, but not this mountain. Aguilar is off on its own, away from all the other mountains. It's like this, it's like all the other mountains want nothing to do with it. It's weird. And that's part of what makes it so intriguing to the people. That's part of what, you know, we can attribute its sacred nature to. But the story is that this mountain is so evil that the angel came down, ripped this particular mountain away from all the others, and stuck it somewhere out on its own so that it wouldn't contaminate the other mountains with its evil. that interesting. So what makes this mountain so evil? That brings me to the myth of Aquilaire. All right, so I'm just going to start telling you the story the best I can. We'll have to probably stop and do a little talking along the way, but here goes. Izar and Lenoa were two orphan children, 7 and 9. These poor children frequented the mountains, earning a living as singing ballads, by singing ballads. Izar, the younger brother, his hair fell in curls, pale as the stems of the maize. His eyes were of the purest sky blue. Izar was the more patient of the brothers, the meeker and the more beautiful. His voice had a purer tone, and for that was the favorite of the inhabitants of the mountains. Lenoa was more lithe, his limbs of stronger make, his black eyes haughty and full of daring, a passionate, proud character. His hair was black, with bluish shades seen on the feathers of the raven. Lenoa was a good lad and loved his younger brother. All right, so we're just opening up the main characters here. Brothers, orphans, Izar, Lenoa. Izar the younger, Lenoa the older. The younger in younger brother fashion is, he's more meek. He's, more patient. The older brother is the leader. He's more arrogant, more haughty. They kind of have this really clear opposition, not only in their personalities, but in the way they look. So Izar is younger. He's got blonde hair, blue eyes, that kind of thing. Personality-wise, he's patient and meek. That's how he's described. Where Lenoa is dark hair. His hair is so black, it has that bluish color you often see in raven's feathers. That's what he's described as the total opposite. He's big and strong, where Izar is smaller and frail. He's, haughty and daring. He's got dark hair rather than the blonde. So you get this idea of two very different people, but they're all they have in the world. They're orphans. They just have each other, and they love one another. All right, the story goes on. It says, it was on a sad day. These two were crossing the mountains, enveloped in a fog and covered with snow. Izar grew very tired climbing and had not the courage to ask his brother to help him up. All at once, a gust of wind brought down large masses of wet, heavy snow into the narrow pass through which they walked. Izar rose up and noticed with deep sorrow that his brother had disappeared. He ran in all directions, calling him, but the fog was so dense he was unable to find him. Then, half dead with fatigue, in despair and shivering, the poor child perceived through the fog an immense tree, and its trunk was hollow. From the hollow of the tree could be seen a white mist which rose and fell. The tree stood in the center of a small plain, surrounded on all sides by thick brushwood, so tangled he could discover no opening. He began to cry. He fervently commended his soul to God and prayed to deliver his elder brother. Having done this, he sat down, and the sleep of innocence very soon closed his eyes. All right, so Izar and Lenoa get separated. It sounds like some sort of avalanche happens. They get separated from each other. Neither of them could find one another. The younger brother is all by himself, finds himself in this part of the mountain that opens up, and he can't even find a way out. He's stuck here in this place. But right in the middle of it is this giant old tree, and it's hollow. So if it's windy and snowy and cold and wet and, you're scared and lost, you're going to do what he did. Lenoa goes into the tree for shelter, and there he eventually falls asleep. Now, I want to mention a couple things here. Going back to von Franz, whenever a transition happens in a fairy tale or folk tale, When a transition happens from a natural setting to a supernatural setting, or from natural behaviors or activity to something more unexplainable, this is usually accompanied by some symbolism that could be understood as a transition from the conscious world to the unconscious world, from the waking world to the dreaming world, something like that. And this transition is like crossing over into the land of the gods, the land of the spirit, the land where, you know, magic can happen, the land where unexplainable things are, that sort of a thing. So when Izar goes to sleep, the sleep is a very common transition. It's almost like you're falling asleep to the real world and you're waking up in a dream world, something like that. And the story continues, you know, Freddy Krueger style in the dream world. But the tree is also important and also has mythological significance. Trees are very heavily represented in world religions. In this case, you have this hollow tree, which looks something like a door, something like a gateway. And I'm just sort of imagining like the cupboard from Narnia, where you go in and suddenly you're in this new world. This is something like what's happened. Izar goes into the tree, some kind of portal. He falls asleep. This is the transition into the mythological world. And when he wakes up, the story continues. So this tree, again, is symbolically significant. Usually trees and myths are considered to be something like the Axis Mundi, the center of the world. And the sometimes it's even called the world tree. In the Norse religion, that tree is called Yggdrasil. And Yggdrasil basically connects. It's the thing that connects all of the realms, all of the worlds, the places where the gods are, the places where the elves are, the places where mankind is. The world tree is that which connects all of the realms. Sacred groves, by the way, in Germanic mythology, they were considered like churches, you know, places of worship. So trees have very, very deep mythological significance, and I think this is no exception here in the Basque story. So he continues. He was suddenly aroused by an uproar. He cautiously peeped out of the hollow trunk, and out of four cardinal points rose up four lines of fantastic shadows, from which issued terrible, unearthly cries. And these shadows all traveled to meet in a concentric point. He began to see that they were mounted, one upon the skeleton of a mammoth, the other rode a monstrous owl, others on broomsticks. Some were perched on the backs of serpents, bearing enormous wings. They greeted one another with frenzied cries and began to descend to the ground. All right, so you see what I mean. He falls asleep in the real world. He wakes up, and this is what he sees. He sees shadows streaming out of the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. I can't help but think of the Harry Potter book, one of the latter ones, where where everybody takes the potion to all look like Harry Potter so that he can escape, and the Death Eaters aren't going to know which is the right Harry Potter, and they're all like buzzing around on broomsticks, and there's like clouds of smoke behind them, and that's kind of the image that comes to my head here, so forgive me. But all these streams of smoke coming from all the four cardinal directions, basically from everywhere, and they're all going to meet at one place. And as they get closer to that one place, it happens to be right there where Izar is, right where this tree is. He can see that the shadows are mounted, that they're riding on things, you know. And again, you might think of the Thestral from Harry Potter, but it's even stranger. Like one of these fantastic creatures comes riding in on the skeleton of a mammoth, right? Not a mammoth, but the skeleton of a mammoth. By the way, that's far closer to the Thestral example than I intended. The Thestral, if you don't know, in Harry Potter, is like this winged horse that's animated and alive, but it's actually just a skeleton. It's a skeleton of a horse with wings. And this is what one of these shadows is riding on, the skeleton of a mammoth. I don't know if you guys remember the movie Alexander with Colin Farrell, but there's a scene in that movie where Colin Farrell, he rears up in battle on his horse against the Indian army, who's reared up on the elephant, right? So you see this horse reared up right next to this elephant, both of them, you know, up on their hind legs, and the size of the elephant is so dramatic compared to the horse, which you know is huge. So this is what we're seeing. One of these people is on the skeleton of a mammoth. So this is bigger than a freaking Asian elephant. This is what you have to see. Another is on a giant owl. Others on broomsticks, a more traditional vehicle for witches, who these shadows are soon going to reveal themselves to be. And then others on the back of these serpents with wings. These are like therianthrope creatures, like a hodgepodge of, you know, certain animal characteristics, like a griffin or a sphinx, right? Some of these mythological creatures that are like combinations of man and animal, or different kind of animal things. All right, so I want to break this down here just as far as the significance goes. When the shadows come in from four cardinal points, the four cardinal directions are always in traditional religions and in prehistoric and ancient pagan religions, very significant. The four cardinal directions, north, west, south, east, and west, are associated with knowledge of the stars. They're associated with knowledge of the heavens. And so they become integrated into myths, the four corners, the four winds, that kind of thing. There's also a reference that maybe should seem a little bit obvious to you as well, of the four horsemen of Revelation, right? Remember, these witches are mounted, right, riding on the skeleton of a mammoth, and so you have the four horsemen of the apocalypse from the biblical story, also mounted, also, you know, evil, and so you have some connections, I think, there. I don't know whether this is specifically one of those Christian overlays, but interesting nonetheless. And these therianthrope images are also interesting. They're a relic of shamanism. They're a relic, I believe, of our earliest religious experiences and instincts. When folks have altered states of consciousness in a religious context, often the visions that they come back with are fantastic. And many of them are of therianthropes. They're of half-animal, half-man creatures, or, you know, creatures with different characteristics from different animals. The dragon is a great example. You know, you have the body of a serpent. You have the, you know, maybe the legs and musculature and jowls of a lion. You've got the wings of an eagle. You've got the, you know, all these different things merged into one creature. So I think it's interesting that we see therianthropes here, right? The serpents with wings and so forth. If you want an example of how the therianthrope idea, and again, evidence from what I suggest that shamanism, that these are images from shamanism, and that shamanism is the origin of all religious traditions, you might wonder, do we have evidence of this, you know, in the Bible? And Ezekiel has a great description of cherubims, of angels. And I'll just read to you really quickly from the Bible, from Ezekiel. It describes them like this, quote, "Every one having four faces. The first face was the face of a cherub, and the second face was the face of a man, and the third face, the face of a lion, and the fourth face, the face of an eagle." So you can see here, even in the Bible, therianthrope images associated with religious visions. Isn't that interesting? All right, story continues. "The terror of Izar increased when he perceived that all of these shadows were so many forms of decrepit old women. And they were taking one another's hand and forming a large circle around the tree in which he had taken refuge. A dance commenced. At first slow, little by little the leaps became more violent, the turns more rapid, until at length it turned into a whirlwind. All right, so here he is stuck in the tree that he went into for shelter. Now he's trapped in there, terrified, as these witches who zoomed in, you know, on smoke, riding on terrible creatures, you know, are now doing this intense, incredible dance all around the tree where he's hiding. Seemingly, they don't have any idea he's there. But what I want to point to here is the idea of dancing around the tree. I don't know, you know, sometimes I get images pop in my head about the witch trials, the Salem witch trials. One of the things that I don't know if this is probably from a movie or a show or something about it, but the images of are these, you know, young girls, these young Puritan girls who escape their houses in the middle of the night, and they're out dancing naked in the forest, and that's one of the signs that these people were possessed by the devil or worshiping the devil or whatever, because they're out there doing that. Well, this is actually a very pagan thing, and not at all an unusual thing in paganism. Remember, we talked about the sacred groves earlier, and these you know, ancient patches of trees in the forest being places of worship where you go, you know, to do rituals and to commune with nature, maybe something like that. And this idea of dancing around a tree or dancing around a pole is common all over the world in tribal religions. You know, maybe it's a totem pole. Maybe it's, isn't there like a May Day pole or something like that with deep historical roots? But the pole represents the sacred mountain. It also represents that tree of life, that tree in the center of the cosmos. So this is something that could very well be in a description of a pagan religious ritual that the story, being a Christianized story, has turned into witches worshiping the devil. But if we took away all of the Christian context, what we would have is women dancing around this ancient tree. And this is something that easily sounds like a common pagan ritual. You know, probably something to do with the new year or worshiping nature, you know, whatever it is. Not necessarily some sort of an evil ritual, what this story is going to make it out to be. So let's continue reading. Poor Izar fell fainting to the ground. When he recovered, these fiendish women were all huddled up close together around a throne of ebony, upon which was seen sitting an enormous he-goat. The old women were approaching the throne. Each respectfully kissed the hairy cloven foot. Then the goat shook his head, and one by one, each of the creatures commenced to relate what she had done. All right, so this crazy dance, this whirlwind dance is going on around the tree. Eyes are kind of blacks out. He can't even handle it anymore. And then when he finally comes to and looks out, the dance is over. There's this giant black throne with a goat sitting on it. Remember, Aquilaire is a goat mountain, essentially. So here you have the goat sitting on this throne, and the witches are one by one kissing the hooves of the goat and kind of confessing what they have done. Okay, it goes on. Izar, horrified at their hideous narratives of premeditated deaths, mutilation of babes, profanation of cemeteries and other crimes, was once more about to faint when he heard a sweet voice pronounce his name. He raised his eyes and saw among the branches a young man of celestial beauty who said, quote, "Listen and do not fear." Now, I don't know what comes to your mind when you hear what amounts to an angel, like a cherub, you know, a beautiful youth who appears in the tree floating above him. Yeah, that sounds like an angel. And he says, "Listen and fear not." And I can't help but think about the Bible again, and in many places, but in the book of Isaiah in chapter 41, it says, God says, "Fear not, for I am with you." And this is a common refrain in Christianity. It's like, have faith in God, and having faith in God requires that you put your fears away, right? You're putting your trust in God, and you're putting your fears away. And this is what God says, "Fear not, for I am with you." And this angel tells Izar, listen and fear not. So the story continues. Izar bends his ear to listen. He wants to hear what these witches are saying. And this is what one of them says. You know, my lord, that the grand reigning duke and his lady are both Christians and have a daughter lovely as the sun. What a joy to me to make this beautiful creature die by inches, to wither that flower in all its youth, and to sow despair in the hearts of her parents, and so deliver them up to your powerful temptations. And the devil replies, remember the goat sitting on the black throne. Should you do so, replied the author of evil, you will become the best beloved of my daughters. And she replies, well then, give me my reward, my lord. It is now a week since the princess began to suffer, and no one is able to discover the remedies to effect her cure. And the devil says, are you not afraid that someone will discover it? She says, no, my lord, because the spell which binds her consists in a toad, which lies concealed under a broken statue in a corner of the garden of the ducal residence. So long as this toad is not destroyed, the sickness will follow its course, and the princess will die. The devil says, this pleases me greatly, Bizati. Apparently her name is Bizati. Saying this, the evil one shook his head. A terrible thunderclap was heard, and the throne disappeared along with he who sat upon it. Soon after, Izar heard the noise of the witches taking to flight on the winds. All right, so this scene sort of settles, right? The devil, the witch is promised this great duke, this great important person. She's gonna deliver not only the duke and his wife, but his beautiful, innocent young daughter to the devil. And the devil's like, fucking A. You do that, you'll be my favorite witch. All right, so boom, the throne disappears, thunderclap is heard, the witches all fly away, presumably to go do naughty things. And Izar looks up and saw the young man who had bidden him have no fear. The angel said, fulfill your mission as I have fulfilled mine. Then spreading his wings, he rose to the sky. So the angel says to Izar, fulfill your mission as I have fulfilled mine. And what's interesting here is he doesn't tell Izar what to do. He doesn't tell him what his mission is. He didn't even tell Izar what his own mission was that he's fulfilled. Clearly, that mission was to come down to Izar, protect him, and make sure he overheard what the witches said. The implication being that Izar's mission is exactly what he heard the witches say. This beautiful, you know, princess and this good Christian duke and wife, they're at risk, and this princess is going to die unless someone does something about it. So the angel says, fulfill your mission. This is Izar's mission. It says, Izar walked on. He continued night and day towards Italy, for it was in one of its small states that the Grand Duke reigned. It would certainly have been a difficult feat for Izar to succeed in approaching so high a personage, had not the Duchess noticed at that moment a poor child was at the gates. Supposing it was to solicit alms, she beckoned and gave him a silver coin, saying, take this, poor child, and ask our dear Lord to grant that my daughter may be restored to health. All right, so here I want to mention, Izar is obviously going to Italy. He knows kind of the gist of where he needs to go because he knows where this duke is. But he knows he's an orphan kid from another country. He's not going to be able to get an audience with the duke. So he's just going there, winging it, hoping that the fates, that you know, the angels clear the path for him to make this happen. And that's exactly what happens. He gets to the village. He just happens to bump into the Duchess herself, the duke's wife. And I can't help but point out that there's something similar here that happens with Moses in the Bible. If you remember, Moses' mother puts him in the basket and puts him on the Nile, and off he goes. But who saves him? Right, it's the daughter of the Pharaoh. She picks him up. She takes him to she basically is the key that gets him into the royal palace. And this is exactly what happens to Izar. He has this, you know, random encounter, coincidentally, with the Duchess, and she's the key that takes, she's the Pharaoh's daughter. She takes him into to the royal palace. All right, so she thinks that this orphan is there because he needs food or whatever, so she gives him a coin, and she asks him to pray for her daughter. And Izar says, "Is it your daughter that is sick?" She replies, "Yes." He says, "Then I will cure her." Okay. While this was taking place, the Duke sat by the bedside of his dying child. Her eyes had already lost the light, which was the delight of her parents. And the pallor of her delicate face clearly indicated the approaching end. Nothing could be more terrible than the sorrow of the father as he witnessed the slow agony of his beloved daughter. All right, so the only thing that I really wanted to point out here is that the Duke is sitting there watching his daughter sort of fade away. He's watching the life fade out of her. You know, I mean, this is the worst possible thing for a parent to experience. But the image here is of the life sort of slowly draining out of the child and a young child. And I want to point out that this is actually not an uncommon thread in fairy tales. And this is true in fairy tales that have ancient Germanic roots and fairy tales that have ancient Celtic roots, and apparently in fairy tales that have ancient Basque roots. What I'm referring to here is this idea of a changeling. So if you don't know, many fairy tales talk about children being stolen away from their parents. You know, they go out into the forest, they disappear into a fairy mound. They're never seen again. You know, it's usually they're doing something they're not supposed to do. They're pushing the boundaries, going somewhere they're not supposed to go. And the lesson to be learned by the little children listening to the fairy tale being told is, you know, respect boundaries, respect your parents' authority. Don't do what you're not supposed to do, because you never know when you might get snatched up by a fairy or disappear into a fairy mound. Worse than that is this idea of a changeling, where the fairies replace you with a fake. They take you into the fairyland, and they leave for your parents some fake magical thing that's meant to look like you so that they don't get, you know, the wiser, but it isn't you. And often that thing, that changeling, will die. The parents then think that their child is dead, and they never look for them. And the fairies can just have their way with the mortal children of the world. So this is what's happening to the Duke. He's seeing the life sort of slowly fading out of his daughter, you know, just like we would see with changelings in other fairy tales. And I think that's interesting. Okay. At this moment, the door opened, and the Duchess led Izar by the hand. "Who is this boy?" the Duke says. "I do not know," replied the Duchess. "I met him on my return from the church, and on asking him to pray for our child, he replied that he had come to cure her." The Duke says, "Are you an angel sent by God?" He replies, "I am a poor orphan, my lord, from distant lands." The Duke led the way towards the sick child and made a sign for Izar to approach. He says, "In the name of God, save our Sophia." The Duke then placed both of his hands on the head of that boy, and in a solemn voice said, "I swear by my ducal crown, if you save my daughter, you shall be her brother." All right, so you see this sort of typical fairy tale scenario. Izar's been given a task, right? He's been given a task by the angel, but now by the Duke as well, to save his daughter. And if he does, he won't be an orphan anymore. Not just that. Not only will he be a legitimate son, he's going to be the son of the Duke. Now he's going to be royalty. This is the lottery, essentially. I also want to mention that now we have the princess's name, and her name is Sophia. Now, probably this was not the original name, Basque name, because Sophia is a Latin name, clearly not a Basque name. The name means wisdom. Even the word philosophy comes from philosophia. Sophia means wisdom. And I want to point out here that Sophia is a common mythological motif. Usually when a woman is appears in a myth or a legend and she represents wisdom, she's called Sophia. So we see this in the Gnostic Christian books, by the way. Sophia is a sort of mythological creature. She's often associated with the Holy Spirit. But again, wisdom. She is something like a representation of wisdom. And so the question I ask, and maybe it's not so clear in this version, but maybe it was in the older version before it was Christianized, is this myth supposed to be something like a quest for wisdom? Because this is a common hero story. You know, a quest for the virgin, for the princess, that's also, you know, along these same lines, but a quest for wisdom too. You know, this is a common, common hero story. So if Izar is trying to save Sophia before she dies, could the interpretation of the story be something like Izar's hero story is the quest to save wisdom? I just wonder if there's something like that going on here. All right, so the Duke says, if you save my daughter, I promise you will be her brother. It goes on like this. Izar thanked him and swiftly left the chamber, requesting that no one should follow him. He descended the stairs and went into the garden. He searched every nook and corner until he discovered, hidden away, a broken statue covered with masses of tangled thorns and briars. By a great effort, he was able to raise the broken statue, when to his great delight, he found the loathsome toad, which glared with fierce, wild looks. Izar jumped on the toad and crushed it dead. All right. So, you know, obviously this orphan kid has never been to the ducal residence. He's never been to the palace before. But he goes out he finds his way out into the garden nonetheless. It's all overgrown, which we were told was the case. And no one's ever going to go looking in the garden. No one's ever going to find the toad because the garden's not kept. You know, all the statues are broken. It's not being maintained. No one ever goes there. No one will ever find it. Of course, he knows because he heard the witch say where it was and what to look for. So he goes. I can imagine a child in a strange place. He's probably, panicking to some degree. The time is ticking. The princess is dying. He doesn't know where he is. You know, he's roaming through this wild, overgrown garden. He finds the statue. But remember, he's a child. He's 7 years old. He's like struggling even to lift it off the ground. So it was like a real Herculean effort for him. And when he pulls this statue up, there he finds exactly what he hopes to find, the loathsome toad. And he jumps on it and he crushes it and he kills it because he knows he must to break this curse. But I would be remiss. I can't read by this and not stop for a second on the toad looking up at him, glaring at him with fierce and wild looks, right? And you're supposed to understand that the toad is cursed and evil and needs to die and all that. But can you imagine a toad looking at you with fierce and wild looks? I just think that's funny, man. I just think it's funny. All right, but another thing I want to bring up here, which I think is interesting, and I don't know how to explain it, is that there's a parallel here to another fairy tale that's very familiar, very famous. We all know it. A fairy tale is Rumpelstiltskin. And so what happens in Rumpelstiltskin is that the hero overhears the fairy, Rumpelstiltskin, out in the woods, dancing around, thinking he's alone, kind of celebrating the joy and the glee that he gets to keep this firstborn baby of the woman that he was helping to spin hay or whatever it is into gold for the king. And he's made this deal with her. He gets her firstborn child. And the only way to avoid this happening is if the princess can guess his name, right? And he's out there in the forest gleefully, you know, dancing around saying, she's never going to be able to guess my name because I've got this crazy name no one's ever heard of and she'll never guess it. My name's Rumpelstiltskin. So she overhears him saying exactly what she needs to break the curse. Now, this is exactly what happened to Izar. He's in the tree. The witches are circling around. They say to the devil, this princess is going to die unless somebody kills this toad, and nobody will ever do that. So this is an interesting parallel. I think it must mean something that in fairy tales, Rumpelstiltskin, I believe, being a Germanic tale, and this Basque tale, having the same sort of motif. Maybe it means something like always pay attention. Maybe it means something like your enemy deserves more attention than your friend. You know, keep your enemies close. That kind of a thing. Maybe it has some moral to it like that. It's like you want to pay attention. You want to be listening, especially to your enemies, because you never know what they're going to volunteer. So maybe there's something like this involved as well. All right, so he crushes the toad. He says, then he quickly returns to the sick room, where all were awaiting. Approached the bed and said, Sophia, my sister, do you hear me? Right, so you see, he immediately, when he comes back, refers to her as his sister, like he's already claiming the prize. And she replies, yes. And he says to her, rise up, for now you are cured. I can't help but hear, you know, with Jesus parallels in that as well. Rise up, for you are cured. The princess rose slowly and looked around as one awakening from a heavy sleep. The Duke clasped Izar in his arms and said, in the name of the God of heaven, I adopt as my own son this orphan. Right, so now he's got this culmination of the hero story. He's won royal standing. He saved the princess. Now he's a prince. All this, you know, this is his hero story. All right, now this is where the story sort of pivots. It says that the fame of this marvelous event soon spread throughout Italy, traversed the Alps, and passed on to the Basque bards. So the idea is that the story of Izar coming to the Duke and saving the princess and all this stuff, this whole story has now been recounted and it's basically spread all through the land. Everybody knows the story of Izar. And now we're basically going to rewind and we're going to pick up where we left off when the brothers got separated, you know, in the mountains. There was an avalanche or whatever and the brothers get separated. We've heard Izar's story. And now we're going to go to Lanoa's side of the story. It says, poor Lanoa became desperate. He ran all about the place calling Izar. 5 months passed away in this wandering, ever searching the woods and lonely places. The shepherds who knew him began to suspect that he had committed the crime of Cain. When these suspicions began to gain ground, the ballad about Izar and Sophia were already sung in good Basque verses. It was an exact narrative of all that had occurred from the separation of the brothers to the adoption by the Grand Duke. And it was not long before this song reached the ears of Lanoa. All right, so you got this scene here. Lanoa is just as desperately looking for Izar. And in fact, he kept looking for Izar for months and months, wandering the woods and the mountains, searching everywhere, trying to find his brother. He's dedicated to his brother. And the people who saw him, the shepherds there, who saw him in the mountains looking, roaming around, thought that maybe he committed the crime of Cain. He's out there looking for his brother because he killed his brother and he's kind of gone mad. And I want to point out here that Cain, of course, is a biblical character, Cain and Abel. So this whole thing about, you know, maybe he may have committed the crime of Cain, this is one of those pieces of evidence that the story was Christianized, obviously. I don't know how this line would have read before, you know, the Basques became Christian, or whether this line would be there at all, but that's what it's telling us. Essentially, though, the story gets back to Lanoa eventually. And it goes on like this. From that moment, he heard the ballad. He was assailed by a yearning to see Izar. But his pride resisted. He says, "No, I cruelly abandoned him when he was poor and weak. I should not now that he is rich go and see him. When, like Izar, I shall have performed some noble act, then will I go to him and ask his pardon. I shall go up to the accursed mountain and listen for some secret spoken in the conventicle, and then I will set to work." All right, so the conventicle, I had to look that word up. That's just like when the witches get together. That's like, you know, the meeting of the coven. That's the conventicle. So anyway, pride is coming up again. We remember that Lanoa was proud and kind of boastful in a way that Izar wasn't. And what's happened here is now Lanoa knows where his brother is and that he could go see him, but he kind of doesn't want to. He feels like he abandoned him when they got lost together in the mountains. He wasn't able to find him, so he feels guilt about that. And he's like, now that I know he's safe, I'm just going to go and show up and say, "Hey, you know, please forgive me for, you know, losing you in the mountains." But he feels bad about that because he thinks his brother might think, or that people might think, that he's only doing that now because his brother is rich and might have something to offer him. It's like, where has he been for the last 5 months? You know? So he's kind of, pride is getting in the way of him going to directly to his brother. So he's like, "Look, I'm going to earn the same nobility that my brother earned. So I'll be on the same level as him when I go to see him. And I can tell him that, you know, I was there. I suffered what you suffered," that kind of thing. And this noble act he wants to perform is exactly the act that Izar performed. He wants to prove that he can do what his brother did. So the story continues. "Another motive existed besides to impel him to attempt such an undertaking. It was vanity. He used to say to himself, 'Shall I be less than my brother? He so weak, I so strong. He so gentle and meek, I so brave and hardy. No, no, I will ascend the rugged mountain and challenge all the dangers which may beset me until I attain to my end at any cost.'" So what you want to see here is more of what we saw in the beginning. We have the dark brother attempting to recreate the deeds of the good brother. We have the opposites. Two different examples: the meek, blonde, fair younger brother, the strong, proud, haughty, you know, dark older brother. Both attempting to do the same thing. We know Izar's been through it. Now we're going to see what happens when Lanoa goes through it. And I just want to show you something like opposites, kind of contrasting one another. And the biggest thing to notice, the biggest difference to notice, is what's motivating their behavior. You know, what happened when Izar was in that situation and what happened that put Lanoa in this situation are very different things. All right, so the story continues. "The night was approaching, and Lanoa, following the route described in the ballad, found the tree and concealed himself in its hollow trunk. And so it happened. Towards midnight, Lanoa began to hear a strange noise. A cold sweat ran down his forehead when the shadows formed the whirling dance that had so greatly surprised Izar. A fearful detonation shook the mountain and was followed by the appearance of an ebony throne. Seated upon it was the most horrible figure human eyes ever beheld. The head of the Prince of Darkness was enormous. His eyes resembled the burning crater of a volcano, while out of his mouth issued volumes of dense smoke across rows of yellow pointed teeth. He cast a ferocious glance and cried out, 'Baziati, Baziati, what became of your fine promises?'" So the devil is, you know, calling for the witch that was supposed to have killed the princess to come to him. And she says, "They could not be carried out." She's trembling, you know, "They cannot be carried out. "Silence," the devil replied. "I see that you are of no use to me in this world. Go and await me in the next." He struck the ground, and the witch disappeared down a deep pit which opened at his feet. Lenoa judged that he was lost, and indeed very quickly was grasped by a number of witches who carried him to the foot of the throne of the Prince of Darkness. Lenoa assumed an expression of satirical jesting. "It appears that you do not fear us," continued Luspel. Now they're calling the devil Luspel, which I also had to look up, just kind of a Spanish way of saying Lucifer or the devil. So the devil says, "It appears that you do not fear us. What were you doing in that tree?" And Lenoa says, "I was deriding you." And he's laughing about it, you know. And the devil says, "Do you perchance think that anyone has ever been able to boast that he derided me with impunity?" And Lenoa says, "Yes, I do, seeing that my brother has done so with good result." The devil says, "Oh, so you are the brother of the one who saved the Italian princess." Lenoa turned quick as thought, grasped a witch by the hair of her head, threw her down on the ground, and placed a foot across her throat, then folded his arms and looked fixedly at Satan. Satan says, "You interest me." All right, so I want to stop there for a second. I want you to see how Lenoa has handled himself during this encounter. He gets grabbed by witches, ripped out of the tree, brought in front of the devil, and he's almost like teasing the devil, you know? He tells him he's not afraid of him. He's laughing at the devil. He tells the devil he derides him. And then when he thinks shit's about to hit the fan, he just reaches over and grabs one of these witches that are serving the devil and just throws her to the ground and sticks his foot on her neck, and he crosses his arms and he just stares back at the devil and says, "Now what, bitch?" Like, this is how he's acting, right? This is how he's acting. And the Satan says, "You interest me," right? Why would that be? Because Lenoa is demonstrating pride and arrogance. These are specific things that appeal to the devil, right? The devil's sin is the sin of pride, wanting to be the most high, wanting to usurp God. So that you might say the devil sees himself in Lenoa, right? He's like, "You interest me," right? After he's acting this in this way that would have every reason to make the devil, rip his head right off of his neck. But instead, he's like, "This guy's all right. This guy's all right." And so Lenoa responds, "I, on my part, despise you." And the devil says, "You say this because you are not aware who I am. Approach if you dare and touch my hand." And Lenoa just fearlessly took the hand of Satan, right? Just fearlessly reaches over and grabs it with no hesitation. And the devil says, "Does it burn you?" And Lenoa says, "I do not feel any heat." And the story says, "But the lad's hair stood on end when it felt that scorching hand," right? So he reaches over and grabs the devil's hand, and it's just searing him. And he's like, "I don't feel any heat." Like, the balls on this kid, you know? And the devil says, "That is no proof that you just..." Well, excuse me, Lenoa, he ends that encounter with where he's shaking the devil's hand. He says, "You can well perceive I do not fear you." And the devil says, "That is no proof that you despise me." And Lenoa says, "Do you wish for proof? There you have one." And he spits in the face of the devil. And the story ends like this. To describe the expression of fiendish rage which appeared on the countenance of Satan is not given to any pen to do. He uttered a roar, wrathfully rose, grasped the boy in his clutches, and cast him headlong down the precipice. The body of Lenoa rebounded and fell a lifeless form. But his soul, purified in that trial, rose up to heaven. And that's the myth, you guys. After spitting in the devil's face, he just gets literally lifted up off of his feet, thrown down the mountain to his death. Interesting, though, the way it ends. It says his soul, purified in the trial, rose up to heaven. So Lanoa fails where Izar succeeded in this scenario. And it's no surprise why, when you see the difference in motivation and attitude, the spirit, you know, behind each brother's actions. But even so, even where Lanoa fails, he purifies his soul in an act of sacrifice. Now, it's a very different hero story than Izar's, but it's a hero story nonetheless. Lanoa and Izar both achieved redemption. They both went through the same trial. Both heroes, but very different kinds of heroes. And that brings me to my conclusion. I love a good story, and none better than myths told by campfire, passed by tradition from elder to child. Stories told because they contain some perennial truth, even when that truth has ceased to be obvious. Parables, fables, stories with secret meaning, meaning you grasp unconsciously, even as your logical mind struggles to make it comprehensible. I'm also intrigued by the Christianization of these ancient stories, by the ways in which Christian ideas are integrated into older, explicitly pagan frameworks. What are those selective modifications to the story telling us? And just what exactly filled the space now occupied by those Christian ideas? Like, what was this story originally? What was the angel who encountered Izar before contact with Christianity transformed it into an angel? What were the witches, the devil? How is it that such a story can function in a pagan context and continue to function in a Christian one? What does that mean? It must be that we're dealing here with things archetypal, things which can change masks, so to speak, but which point to the same underlying reality. If we examine the story, we find in it something akin to the mythological motif of the hostile brothers or the hero twins. Now, these are common mythological motifs we see all over the world. These motifs abound in world mythology, as with the twin heroes of the Maya, Hunapu and Chabalenque, or the hero brothers of ancient Greece, Castor and Pollux. The Bible itself is full of examples, Cain and Abel, Isaac and Ishmael, and some would even argue Jesus and Lucifer. With Izar and Lanoa, we have brothers that are represented as opposites. Izar is younger, fair-haired and meek, while Lanoa is the elder, raven-haired, strong and full of pride, right? They are human versions of yin and yang. Now, as the story opens, another parallel unfolds, where Basque tradition tells us that the mountain Aquilaire was lifted by an angel and separated from its brother mountain. Izar, too, is separated from his brother. One must wonder, if the gods separated the mountains to keep evil Aquilaire from contaminating its brother, was the same true of Izar and Lanoa? What we can say, is that away from the influence of his brother, Izar was able to survive his encounter with the devil and his witches, learned a divine secret, and used that secret to save a life and earn salvation for himself. Now, Lanoa walked in Izar's footsteps. He too found the sacred tree. He too hid within and had an encounter with the devil. But he did not succeed as Izar did. Then you might ask why, but the reason is obvious. Where Izar acted selflessly, Lanoa acted out of pride and vanity. Just like we see in the story of Cain and Abel, both brothers offer their sacrifice to God, but only Abel's pleases God. Why? Because of the spirit from which each was offered, its motivation, what was in each of their hearts. Interestingly, In this story, Lanoa earns salvation too. The tale ends with the line, quote, "The body of Lanoa fell, a lifeless form, but his soul, purified in that trial, rose up to heaven." So what happened here, do you think? How did Lanoa earn salvation when his motivations were impure? He couldn't defeat the devil with strength or with pride, but he certainly could with self-sacrifice, like the sacrifice of Jesus, the sacrifice of Creator to creation. Lanoa bravely faced the devil. He looked the dragon in the face, so to speak, and did not waver. He offered his life for the hope of redeeming himself to his brother. And so the story tells us, even in death, and despite our imperfections, we, like Lanoa, can earn redemption, can be worthy of redemption. And just like that, Yin becomes Yang, and the hostile brothers become hero twins.
Well, there you have it. That's one avenue explored, but infinitely more still to go. I hope you enjoyed thinking along with us. I know. It's not easy work. Thinking. It's hard and full of uncertainties, but I'm grateful for the company as we trek through this together. Here's to hoping that the juice is worth the squeeze. See what I did there? Let's find out together in the next episode.